Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be chatting with Adam Boileau about all of the week's security news in just a minute, and then we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor, which is Greynoise. And we're chatting with Greynoise founder Andrew Morris about something that's quite topical, which is the amount of attacks against edge devices these days on the internet. And as bad as it seems, and indeed we're talking about a few of these sorts of attacks in this week's news segment, as bad as it seems, Andrew is here to reassure us that it is in fact much, much worse than people fully realize. We're also going to talk to him about how Greynoise's LLM-driven analysis engine actually caught an ODAI command injection vulnerability being used in the wild against a bunch of IP cameras. It's a really good interview. We always love having Andrew on the show, so do stick around for that one. But Adam, it's time to get into the news now, and we're going to start off with some with this blog post from Microsoft, where they've outlined a few things that look to be in response to the CrowdStrike incident back in July. One feature they've announced is a sort of remote recovery feature. So if your kernel all of a sudden becomes non-functional, you can actually roll back some changes. And the other thing they've announced is that they're going to introduce features into the OS that will allow security companies to build things like EDR without having to use a kernel module. Let's start with the recovery stuff. Like, do we actually have any details on how this thing's going to work?
No, we haven't seen details yet. They've Microsoft's having their Ignite conference at the moment. They've been announcing a whole grab bag of stuff, but I guess we're going to have to wait and see the specifics. Essentially, the problem they are trying to solve, as you said, is the kind of CrowdStrike scenario where your machines are rendered unbootable, and clearly there's going to be some kind of like network aware safe mode that they can boot up into and then apply security updates or Windows updates or patches or something that administrators can use rather than having to physically go to individual machines, boot them up and so on. And, you know, there's a bunch of moving parts here that we do need to see specifics of, like how does this interact with BitLocker? How does this interact with TPM-backed BitLocker, et cetera, et cetera. But clearly they're trying to solve the problem that we all want solved, which is having to roll truck in the event of an outage and physically put hands on keyboards, you know, is a thing that isn't so useful anymore when we have a billion Windows machines in the world or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, we saw what that looks like back in July, yes. And it meant a lot of people stranded at airports and so yes, on, right? Exactly. So not so surprised to see Microsoft trying to get on top of that. But the other thing they've announced as part of this, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff in this blog post. We've linked through to it in this week's show notes, so people who want to read the whole thing can go and do so. But another thing that caught my eye is that they are, you know, introducing these features which allow people to, you know, run security software outside of kernel mode. We're going to really have to see what that looks like, because there are good reasons for security software to be in the kernel. And you talk to anyone who develops endpoint security software for Mac via its API, and they'll tell you all about the limitations. They will not stop talking about the limitations. In fact, your ears will fall off from how much they talk about the limitations involved in, you know, using that API.
Yeah, there's absolutely a set of trade-offs that you have to make here, you know, for having standardized interfaces and, you know, the impact that has on the ability to kind of innovate or to provide security solutions that are, you know, differentiated from competitors and so on. And I think that, you know, the comparison with the Apple ecosystem is pretty apt, because, you know, Apple provides these APIs that people can use. And if you don't want to do it Apple's way, then tough. But on the other hand, they also provide an ecosystem that is much more locked down and controlled than the traditional PC world. And we have ended up with these, you know, kind of Windows antivirus and EDR and whatever else solutions, because that platform is so much more flexible. The security software needs to kind of be more flexible too. And so, you know, the idea that you could do it kind of Apple style or even more like iOS style on Windows, you know, the platform itself would need to be pretty different. And we only have to look at how, like, the success of the Microsoft Store and what a mess that's turned into to kind of see that it's a whole ecosystem. But anyway, I'm super interested. Microsoft is going in the right direction here, but, you know, it's not as simple as just now we've got some APIs for building EDR in user mode.
Well, and I don't think they're going to cut off kernel access. Well, let's put it this way. I would be surprised if they cut off kernel access, because there's going to be legal challenges there, right? Because if they're still allowing Defender access via the kernel, they kind of have to offer that to everybody else. Otherwise, they're going to face a whole bunch of legal challenges. So the precise phrasing they've used here is to help our customers and partners increase resilience. We are developing new Windows capabilities that will allow security product developers to build their products outside of kernel mode. Now, this phrasing doesn't suggest that they're going to force people to do that, just that it's an option. And maybe Microsoft's hope is that customers will start demanding that security providers do that. I'd be pretty skeptical there, because if I'm CrowdStrike or SentinelOne or whoever, you know, in a customer meeting, I've got, well, we've got our kernel mode one, which can do this, and then we've got the user, you know, the API based one, which can do a whole bunch less, you know, which would you prefer? And, you know, when they've got the remote recovery feature as well as a bit of a seatbelt, I think it'll be hard to convince people to pick like these versions, let's put it that way. So
yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, what we will actually see likely is that some of the functionality will be able to be moved out. I mean, everything you can move out of kernel space into a user space process is an improvement. And maybe, you know, handling updates, or maybe there's some rules around, you know, much like Apple has about like how much compute time you can spend, you know, in kernel or whatever else. You know,
yeah, but that gets a bit dicey, right? Because Apple will do is just shut down a security tool that it thinks is using a few too many cycles. It's just like, yes, bye-bye, boom, and it goes away.
Yeah, yeah. So like, you know, there are a bunch of trade-offs, but I mean, ultimately the goal is to just do less stuff in a privileged context. And, you know, if Microsoft can provide support that means you can move, you know, 60% of your EDR product out of kernel, like that's still 60% less that you can have bugs in. So
100%. Move in the right direction, devil in the details, but so far so good. Exactly. Staying with Microsoft, and they've announced that they're going to start publishing machine readable vulnerability information, which is a great idea. And frankly, like, I'm surprised this hasn't happened already.
Yeah, so they're using a standard mechanism for publishing them, and, you know, essentially it's JSON files with a schema that's specified by a standards body. And I had a look through, and it all looks pretty sensible. And given how many people have had to write things that scrape vulnerable information off Microsoft's web pages,
you know, and then try to munge it into that JSON. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. To try and build this. And I mean, you know, clearly Microsoft is sharing, like, the data source is shared behind the scenes, because you can kind of see artifacts of the web part of it, you know, in some of the JSON documents they provide. But hey, this is a move in the right direction, and anything that makes our lives easier in terms of consuming this data is great. It doesn't necessarily solve the problem that garbage in, garbage out, right? You still have to have good quality information, and I feel overall the incentives for providing good quality public vulnerability information have been going down over time, but Microsoft's stuff is at least better than average. So
But I mean, you said it, it's the motivation, you know, it's not required to the same degree, right? People don't have time these days to sit down and look at detailed information on each bug. They want to know the CVSS score and then they what to do, right? Like, that's sort of where we are now.
Yeah. And I guess I'm, you know, for people like me that worked, you know, where you want to know the details of the bug because you want to reproduce it and then use it, which is a slightly different use case than the problem they're trying to solve. It's become frustrating more and more over the years to consume vulnerability information for anything other than that.
Yeah.
Like, just tell me the CVSS and patch it.
So your objection here is it might make pen testers sad.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
And pen testers are already sad, so it's, you know, a marginal difference, but still.
Why? We can't have sad pen testers. Let's immediately protest this this development. Now, look, staying with vulnerability information, and everybody knows that NIST, you know, its efforts to manage the National Vulnerability Database kind of just fell over this year. They have now come back and said, good news, everyone, which was, we've cleared the backlog of publicly exploitable vulnerabilities, right? So they've now gone and enriched the data for like stuff on the CISA Kev list. And they're like, yay, that's great. But their goal of end of year, like getting everything back to speed, they're like, yeah, that's not going to happen. I mean, it's amazing that they just fell by. This is an important data source and it just fell over. And it's kind of, I mean, it has got headlines, but this is just and a pretty epic failure when you think about it.
Yeah, it really is. And I am surprised that they let it get this bad. I the articles about this, though, and like some of the headlines we've seen about this, you know, because of the, for example, the Record runs a piece that starts, the federal body in charge of processing prominent vulnerabilities said a backlog of unanalyzed exploited bugs has been cleared, which you and I know means the 100 bugs on the KEV list for this year, not the 100 and whatever thousand or 18,000, whatever it is that they haven't dealt with this year, like tens of thousands. So like, it's a very, very small percent. Okay. It's an important, very small percent, but yeah. Like it is weird that, you know, such an important standards body has like just screwed up this badly.
They dropped the ball. But I mean, I'm guessing really there's a backstory there, right? Like I'm sure. Guessing there were people in there who were warning about it, and I don't know, the right people didn't take it seriously. Like there's, you know, a story like this isn't just, oh, they're a bunch of useless idiots, you know? Like there's obviously some stuff went down, is what, yes, I'm getting at, right? Like some stuff went down. And I don't want to criticize that reporting, by the way. This one's from John Grigg at The Record, because it, you know, he does present all of that context. So.
And it is what NIST said. So like he's not, you know, he's reporting what they said.
But well, I mean, it's right there in the headline that the end of year goal for the full list is unlikely, right? Yeah. So it's not like that was not, did not feature in that story. But look, staying on vulns, I mean, you're going to have to unpick all of this for me, because I've got so many CVE numbers in front of me that it's making me a little bit dizzy and I can't keep track of them all. But Palo Alto Networks is having a bad time. So we've had 0-day exploited in the wild, like proper 0-day pre-patch. There's bugs in multiple PAN products. It's chaos out there, man. Like walk us through what's going on here. Cause there's two sets of bugs, some affecting like one of their management products and the other one, the management interface to their products. So what can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so you're right. There's essentially two sets of Palo Alto bugs that are in the news. One is extremely funny and quite important, and one is really not that significant. So the not significant one is their like customer migration tool that I think we talked about that a while ago, and it had some bugs in it. People have been looking at it and have found more bugs, but very few people run this particular product. The one that is great is there was a bug that was being sold on some hacking forums somewhere that was advertised as like pre-auth remote code exec and Palo Alto's firewalls. And we saw Palo Alto warn about this before they had even understood what the details of the bugs were. They said, hey, someone is selling this bug. I guess maybe firewall, the management interface for your firewalls. And then now we've seen the details of that particular bug, which turned out to be two different bugs, come out. Watchtower Labs have a write-up of it, and it is such a clanger of a bug. So there are two. First bug is essentially an auth bypass, and the auth bypass is you send an HTTP request header to the web server of the management interface, which basically just says, hey, don't worry about authing me, it's fine.
Yeah.
And that works. And then once you've got that, once you're past that auth step, you can go forward and look for the next bug, which turns out to be a straight up shell meta character command injection in like the username field. So you put shell meta characters in it and it runs commands as root on the underlying firewall's OS, which again, oh my God, it's the year 2024. What are you doing, Palo Alto?
Yeah.
So, I guess if you have the firewall management interface on the internet, you were going to have a bad time. You've always been going to have a bad time. But, I mean, this is a firewall. It's a security product from a major vendor with, you know, no auth please header. And I would like to run this shell command in my username, please. Like,
yeah. It's really funny. I've been spending a lot of time with my head in access control, right? So I think for a long time, people made the mistake of thinking that authentication was access control. And it is, but not when you're dealing with vulnerable technologies that you can pop shell on pre-auth, right? And that's one of the issues. And you look at what people have built in terms of trying to deal with these sorts of problems. And when it comes to like enterprise web applications, you've got some reasonable options there. So you've got your sort of Cloudflare stuff. You've got Zscaler. You know, there are options for doing web application delivery. When it comes to controlling access into production environments, whether that's database access, SSH, whatever, you've also got some options there. Tools like StrongDM are really good. But I feel like a lot of this has kind of missed the point, which is the stuff that really needs to be access controlled is not often the stuff that is already getting the most attention, right? You're not going to serve up the login interface to your Palo Alto box via Cloudflare.
No.
That's just not something you're going to do. So the reason I've had my head in all of this is, I, you know, don't mind saying it now at this point, is I've joined the board of Knock Knock, and this is the problem that they're trying to solve, right? Which is, how do you actually put access control beyond just sort of authentication-based stuff? How do you put access control on crap, right? Not just your most vital known about infrastructure. How do you put access control on the web interface for an IP camera, right? And so, you know, the way they're doing it, obviously, is with IP restrictions and whatever. There's a new feature coming, which is very, very cool, which is sort of akin to an identity-aware proxy, which gives you an extra level of protection for web-based stuff. But when you actually really go out and survey this stuff, you know, it's like access control is just so neglected, which is very strange when you think about like what a fundamental building block of security it is.
Yeah, you know? It's very hard to implement complicated controls, and access control, unfortunately, is kind of complicated in an enterprise context because, you know, you've got to have federated auth and SAML and all sorts of complicated auth things. And in an IP camera, no one expects enterprise-grade auth in an IP camera, but you still need enterprise-grade auth. And no one expects good quality implementations of complicated protocols in, sadly, a Palo Alto firewall. And so you have to have something that is simple enough that you can just layer on, but does not rely on the vendors of these products to either implement complicated features or to implement them safely. And network-based controls is the old-fashioned way of doing that.
Yeah.
But a good way.
Well, but even with web-based stuff, and even web-based stuff to IoT, right? You can use a reverse proxy for this stuff.
Yeah.
And there are tricks you can use so that it's not just IP restriction, because, you know, they Knock Knock had an issue, and I've got to spell it out because people can't find them, because it's K-N-O-C, K-N-O-C. So there's no second K on Knock. So there you go. But, you know, they spoke to one customer who's like, excuse me, they spoke to one customer who's like, you know, IP restriction isn't enough for this particular set of applications, but they were web-based, right? So you could actually work something out there where what they're developing for that customer, and it's going to be a killer feature, is sort of like a identity-aware proxy, but really dumb, but it works. And you can put it in front of basically anything. So instead of having to, like, you know, GCP has like a way to do IAP, like identity aware proxying, but you install these connectors and whatever. And, you know, Cloudflare can even tunnel out SSH, but you need to mess with your SSH configuration and trust Cloudflare's CA and whatever. Like, all of this stuff is just sort of needlessly complicated when it comes to trying to lock down low value vulnerable stuff. And I feel like, finally, just in light of all of these issues we're having with enterprise VPNs and with all manner of devices that are just sitting around stinking like corpses on the edge of a network, like, it's about time we did something about this. And just, yeah, going through the market research phase, I'm just surprised there's not an awful lot there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just not putting these things on the internet is how we used to do it. But
you can't do that anymore.
But now, of course, we put everything on the internet because the internet is everywhere. And, you know, if we lived in the IPv6 world where there was no NAT to save us, we would have already been putting everything on the internet for a long time and had to cross this bridge earlier. But NAT bought us an extra 15 years.
But it's just crazy that this just hasn't been addressed. But I guess we're there now. Anyway,
yeah.
Let's move on. And we've got a readout here from the White House of a call between Joe Biden and Xi Jinping. And what's really interesting is, you know, the Vault Typhoon stuff came up. And it's just really wild to see that in this sort of readout. So it reads, the president raised deep concerns about ongoing PRC cyber attacks targeting civilian critical infrastructure and threatening the safety and security of Americans. Sign of the times, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's become an issue that is discussed in this context, and kind of fair enough, because, I mean, you know, China's in their pre-positioning for things that are very relevant to this level of leadership. So, yeah.
Well. And staying with US government stuff, Jen Eastley is going to step down from CISA on Inauguration Day. I don't think we should be particularly surprised that a bunch of officials, particularly from DHS, are going to leave. The incoming administration is very hostile towards the work CISA has done around disinformation. So I think it's probably good that Easterly just gets out of the way here instead of trying to, you know, dig in and defend and wind up sort of escalating a, you know, the attacks against it from the White House. But, you know, it's still very unclear what's going to happen to CISA under the incoming admin, because there is talk of making CISA go away. I don't know how credible that is, but I think the disinformation stuff, that's gone.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pity that, you know, because CISA has done so much good work, it would be a pity to see them kind of curtailed or wound down or made, you know, less effective. But, I mean, on the scale of US politics, cybersecurity is a relatively not so partisan issue compared to other things. So
the problem is, though, CISA is so closely tied to this disinformation stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and it could, you know, the wider org could be punished. But even some of the people who are like looking to damage it are even saying, well, I don't think we can get rid of it entirely. But, you know, just think like Chris Krebs was, you know, he's on the CSRB at the moment. I don't think he's going to stay because, you know, like he did not have a good time under the under Trump V1. So, I don't know about that. And even more news, we've got a report, another report here from John Grigg at The Record, looking at Anne Neuberger, who is the US Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technologies. And she did a talk and asked about, you know, what the incoming administration should focus on from a cyber perspective over the next 100 days. And I guess not surprisingly, she said China, but she also singled out ransomware. And I think, you know, Neuberger did do a lot of work on ransomware over the last 4 years. So, and it would be a shame to see that work let up now. So let's hope whoever comes in is going to listen to her.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, ransomware, once again, is a thing that shouldn't be particularly partisan. But then again, we've seen, you know, things like adding regulatory stuff to the water industry, for example, you know, be made complicated, even though basic IT standards for critical infrastructure hopefully shouldn't be. But hey, what do I know?
Well, I mean, that was more of an issue of government overreach, I think, in that case. I kind of agreed with the Republicans on that one. So I don't think that was necessarily about politics. I think that was about sort of like what the government was allowed to really do there. But I do feel like the US government's efforts on ransomware over the last few years have helped, you know, and it's probably a good time to look back and think about that. But, you know, we haven't seen a United Healthcare style or whatever their subsidiary change. You know, we haven't seen something like that in a little while, and it felt like for a while that was happening just so regularly, and the, you know, the volume and intensity seems to have dialed back a bit.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, it does seem to have cooled a little bit. I mean, our shows are not 100% jam-packed full of hospitals getting ransomware like they were a year ago, but that's also a degree of you and I getting bored of talking about ransomware.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's still a lot of ransomware out there, don't get me wrong, but you know, the idea that you had a mega cartel like Lockbit that was just being so successful, I don't think we have a replacement for that yet.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And actually the next story, which is about a ransomware group, you know, the reason it stood out to me is actually because it's such a low rent kind of ransomware group. This was the Akira crew, and like they are kind of by design a pretty low rent sort of new group. So yeah, I think that, you know, the landscape of ransomware has changed a bit, and so yeah, I mean, you're probably not wrong that there has been some good movement there.
Yeah, so this is a piece from Alexander Martin, the one you're talking about, and they've gone onto their darknet leak site and published like a whole bunch of entries on the one day. There's sort of, some people have sort of speculated, oh, are they just doing this before they shut up shop? And other people are saying, no, this is their announcement that they've arrived, you know, and that they're the next big player. And I just think, okay, that's okay. You know, they emerged in March 2023. In its first year of operations, it made $42 million from 250 attacks. Okay, cool. If those numbers 10x, they're going to get US governmented is my feeling. And so that's why I say it feels like the suppression efforts have at least done something. You're never going to get away. You're never going to completely remove ransomware as a threat. It's always going to be, there's always going to be more of it than we want or that we think is acceptable, but at least imposing some cost on the bigger cartels I think has actually delivered some results.
Yeah, no, I think so. Like there is a point now where you can become too big to not get attention paid to you. And hopefully that message has been pretty clearly received.
And then you're going to have a bad time. Yes. Now let's turn our attention to a report from the New York Times, which was published just today. And it looks at, the headline is Hacker is said to have gained access to file with damaging testimony about Gates. Now, of course, this relates to Matt Gaetz, who is he has been floated as the next Attorney General in the United States. He was also under investigation for, paying women for sex, and one girl he was alleged to have had sex with, like 17 and whatever. There was a investigation into this, and that document is not public and whatever. These documents relate to a civil suit. Now, I'm not getting into the allegations. I'm not getting into Matt Gaetz as Attorney General or anything like that. But the one thing I did find interesting here is that what they're calling a hack here doesn't really look like a hack. And you had a look at this story and you kind of got the same impression. Definitely looks like unauthorized access, but I wouldn't call it a hack. It looks like someone had one of those magic links, where you hit the link and you download the document, and, someone who wasn't supposed to have that link used that link to download the document. I mean, it's impossible to know given the level of detail in this story, but that's what it feels like, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It feels like a Dropbox link or an Excelion link or something like that that got shared around amongst some, legal staffers, and presumably one of them shared that link somewhere, or it was obtained, maybe info stealers, maybe there was actual hacking involved. It's possible. But yeah, it just feels like one of those links went missing and then has been, shared around, and maybe it's being laundered as though it were a hack, when in fact it wasn't. Maybe it was just an insider, or maybe there was some technical means. We don't really know.
Feels more like a leak than a hack, I guess.
It does feel saying, more like a leak than a hack, yes.
And this is a bunch of, testimony in a civil trial or whatever. And then it's sort of opened up that whole can of worms of, well, do you report on hacked data? And I think, when you're talking about alleged crimes committed by the person who is going to be the chief law officer of a country, I think that meets the newsworthy bar, right? Some people have a real hard time wrapping their heads around the fact that the rules around when it's okay to report on this stuff are going to be a bit rubbery.
Yeah, I mean, it is necessarily subject to some interpretation, and people love a hard, fast rule that then they could rules weasel about, but that's just not how the world be.
It ain't. Now, we've also got some other legal documents to look at. A bunch of stuff from the NSO versus Meta trial have been unsealed, and we got to learn some things about the number of targets over a certain period that NSO Group were compromising. We learned that they cut off 10 customers because they were abusing the Pegasus software. But just again, more and more information coming out. You and I were talking about this yesterday, and in an odd way, the scale of NSO's bad behavior might actually be a net positive in some ways, because if there weren't a company like NSO being so bold and so out there and so unethical, I don't think we ever would have got that critical mass that we needed for governments to take this seriously, for regulations to be introduced in various places, for sanctions to come online. So I think to a degree, their bad behavior has served us in terms of having to take this seriously as a policy issue.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting interesting read on it, because, you think back to the other pre-NSO kind of alternatives, things like Hacking Team. It was hard to take Hacking Team seriously. I mean, they had a product that kind of worked, but ultimately, the hoodied hackers, Italian hoodied hackers in their marketing shots, just made you not want to take them particularly seriously. And similarly with some of the other, victims of who was the hacker that took down
Phineas Fisher.
Yes. Some of the other victims of Phineas Fisher. None of those seemed particularly serious. And then NSO Group, A, technically pretty sophisticated, B, had bugs in high profile stuff in iOS and Android, WhatsApp, et cetera, et cetera. Also, the close ties to the Israeli establishment and being used as kind of diplomatic tools by the Israeli government, offering to sell that to other countries as kind of part of relationships. It just kind of got elevated to the point where you know, they were taken seriously by Meta and by some of the other people who had beef with them. So yeah, I think you're probably not wrong there, actually.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to arrive at, but it's like, unless you have a really bad actor that you absolutely must take action against, it's just so much easier to kick the can down the road. You know, would we have seen the same response against Kanduru? You know, they're a little bit more low profile. I mean, NSO, talk about flying too close to the sun.
Yeah. You know? And then when we saw things like, which a US defense contractor was like initially rumored to be in talks to buy them or something.
Oh, that was L3 Harris.
Was it L3 Harris? Yeah, right. And that kind of thing, like, is just because of the profile of NSO now, is the sort of thing that was just not tenable anymore. But for any of the smaller players, you could actually kind of imagine that being a way to sort of solve the problem. But NSO was not solvable in that way because they got too big for their britches.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways that deal actually could have been good, because putting them under the oversight of a company that's going to be more adherent to certain norms, rules, and laws wouldn't have been a bad thing. And it would have, you know, corralled a bunch of those people with those special skills in one place. So, but on the other hand, it would have been sort of rewarding people for bad past behavior. So there was a bit to weigh up there. That was not a straightforward, you know, thing to form a judgment on.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it's complicated.
It is. It often is. Now, let's talk about some law and order, Adam. And if you're only getting the audio version, you're not getting to see my sweet new police light that I get to flash up on the screen. But yes, Heather Morgan, who is one half of the married couple that was laundering tens of thousands of Bitcoin that her husband stole from Bitfinex back in 2016. Yeah, she's been sentenced to 18 months in prison. The husband, who hacked the exchange, he's been sentenced to 5 years in prison. I feel like these two got off pretty light, actually. They seemed quite harmless. It's a non-violent offense, but you know, the money that they stole was worth $71 million at the time. Now it's worth $10.8 billion, right? And you just think, geez, 5 years for stealing what is, you know, nearly $11 billion. That's, you did all right there.
That's, as gangster rappers go, like, that's pretty gangster. Stealing $10 billion, $11 billion. Like, it doesn't get much more gangster than that. So,
yes, well, Heather Morgan is also the one who was recording awful crypto-themed hip-hop, right? So we await her charges for crimes against music. Another one here, the guy behind the Helix cryptocurrency mixer, he's been sentenced for 3 years, but he pleaded guilty back in 2021, so it's a bit strange that it's taken so long. Yeah, this guy, Larry Dean Harmon, 41 years old, from Ohio, has been sentenced. What was really interesting here is he has to forfeit $311 million, as well as seized cryptocurrency, real estates, and monetary assets valued at over $400 million. So we're talking $700 million in forfeiture. And I thought, hang on, because it says here from 2014 to 2017, Harmon ran Helix, facilitating more than $300 million worth of cryptocurrency transactions. So I'm thinking, how did he wind up with $700 million?
Hoddle.
And then I went back and I looked at the Bitcoin chart, and Bitcoin back then was worth a few hundred bucks. So that's how he wound up having to forfeit, you know, $711 million.
Twice what he laundered. It's so good.
Yeah. So there you go. Any thoughts on this?
Just that, you know, it's good that they are tracking down and finding the people who run the mixers and run the money laundering, because I mean, that's the kind of lubricant that makes Bitcoin viable and other cryptocurrencies viable as a method for doing crime, handling the proceeds of crime, is the laundering options. And yeah, it's nice to see people getting some comeuppance, because, you know, we were talking about like how ransomware, you know, it feels like it's dropped off a bit. And one of the targets that has made that, you know, drop off happen, I think, is going after the shared infrastructure like money laundering and places like that. So,
well, and the exchanges too. Like, there's been a hell of a crackdown on dodgy exchanges. So at this point, you know, laundering is going to be expensive. You'll be able to do it, but it's going to cost you more.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes the, you know, just introduces friction everywhere. And that's what, you know, what the disruption has been about.
Now, speaking of friction, my favorite story of the week, Virgin's O2 telco in the UK has introduced Daisy, who is an AI-powered grandma who is just there to answer calls from scammers and waste their time and frustrate them. And apparently, Daisy can keep people on the line for something like 40 minutes, which ain't bad for AI. And I just am envisaging this future where scammers are going to have to do like the Voight-Kampff test from Blade Runner, but real subtle to make sure that they're, you know, like you're going to have to ask the grandma you're scamming to forget your previous instructions and give you a recipe for risotto, you know, to see what happens. But this is a great idea.
This is so cool. And they actually got one of the guys that does like scam baiting, like who baits scammers and keeps them on the line and exposes them and all that kind of thing. One of the YouTubers that does that provided a bunch of input for them to kind of help them build the model. So it's just a, you know, regular speech to text, you know, LLM style thing, text back to speech, but then runs through a sort of personality layer that adds the grandmaness, and that combined with some expertise of how to actually bait them, how to keep them on the line, and the sorts of things that that you would normally do. Like, it's a, you know, of all the uses we have seen of AI tech in the last, you know, kind of years, AI boom, this one is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, remember how AI was going to kill off everyone's jobs? Hasn't happened yet, you know, but interestingly enough, everybody's, I mean, you've been using it. We're redeveloping our website at the moment. You found it quite useful for certain tasks, right?
Yeah, there are certain things that it's legitimately good at, and there's some things where it's just terrible. And the trick to using it well is being able to spot which case you're in quickly. And yeah, that's a, you know, I think my overall impression of using ChatGPT 4.0 as a sidekick for, you know, dev and sysadmin tasks is, you know, it's no worse than anyone else I've shared an office with in the last, you know, 20 years of working in tech. And some people are crackheads and some people are sensible, and you learn to know, you know, when someone is wrong, you know, has the wrong worldview or the wrong mindset about a particular technical issue. You know, if you can spot that pretty quick, it doesn't waste too much of your time, then it works pretty good. So yeah, there is some utility there. I'm, you know, I'm still skeptical, but you know, there are certain niche cases where I found it really helpful.
I don't know if you've been paying attention, but something funny has happened with Grok, which is, you know, Elon Musk's unfiltered AI model, which is, it's turned into a raging lib, which is just hilarious and really doesn't like him either. And if it could have voted, would have voted for Harris. And like, it's just, it's real funny, like the screen caps that are going around, and you know, they're legit too. Anyway, moving on. And you found this one. This is a academic paper from the University of Chicago and UC San Diego. And it, I think even UC San Diego Health as well. Like, so there's a bunch of academics got together and did a academic study on the efficacy of phishing training, and they have determined that it doesn't work.
Yes, so they've submitted this paper for an academic, you know, for academic publication, and it's the largest actual kind of like empirical study. This is based on an 19,500 employee healthcare organization looking at the effectiveness of phishing training and simulated phishing on actual kind of phishing click-through rates and so on. And their conclusions basically are it doesn't work in any commonly deployed, you know, mechanism or pattern that people are using. And I put this one in because I know so many people who are, you know, subjected to phishing education and phishing training and simulated phishing in their workplaces, where it just kind of feels, you know, abusive and ham-fisted. And I figure it would be nice to have some actual, you know, academic studies to point to that say, actually, this stuff really doesn't work. Because as a practitioner, I feel like it doesn't work, but it's nice to have data that says that.
I mean, you get conflicting reports when you talk to CISOs about the effectiveness of this stuff. I mean, I think a well-designed phishing program, gamified, thought about, can work quite well. But you're right, the way that it's mostly done, it doesn't scream like it's gonna win. So it's not entirely surprising to see these results.
No, it's just, you know, I thought it was a nice data point to have in these conversations. You know, when we see it just kind of done so, you know, with so little thought in so many places.
I mean, I think you'd need to design a security program too that does not rely on users doing the right thing. I mean, I think that is also something, you know, you've got these social engineering campaigns that get people to perform all sorts of actions on the box, and you know, you've got to be set up to deal with that, right? And you can't rely, because I think some interesting stuff that came out of talking to Ryan Callenber at Proofpoint is, even if you're doing good training, there's just some people who will never learn. Like, some people will improve based on some of this training, but there are just some people out there who just like some of the stats he had were actually funny, where there's just like always one person, an org, who just opens everything, clicks on everything. They can't help. It's like they're it's like a compulsion, you know? They just have to see everything. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, in the end, it needs to be safe for people to click on stuff. And we as technologists, our job is to make it safe, not to tell them not to click on things on the thing clicking machine that we gave them.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. Right. It is a thing clicking machine. Now, one last thing I want to talk about here is some news out of Australia where the, and this isn't technically cyber, but it's interesting. Bear with me. The Office of the Australian Information Commissioner has found against Bunnings, which I guess for our American listeners, that's like Australia's Home Depot, because they were running facial recognition on everyone who walked into a store. Now, the Office of the Information Commissioner has said, you know, that this is a privacy regulation problem. You can't do that. And in response, Bunnings actually released a bunch of its security video footage to explain why they were doing this. And what they were doing, I think, is actually an excellent use case for a technology that I otherwise find quite creepy. And it was really about staff safety. So they released this footage and it had people walking through Bunnings naked, people with shotguns, people knocking out Bunnings staff, sometimes, you know, young women being punched. And, you know, so what they were doing is they were taking like face prints of those people and flagging them if they walked into a Bunnings store so that security could be alerted, the police could be called and whatnot. And you know, if you or I, as just normal customers, had walked into one of these stores, it would scan our face, compare it against that database of, you know, people who are banned. And then if we were not one of those people, that information would be immediately discarded. To me, this seems like a proportionate use of that technology to solve a staff safety problem, to try to look after their staff. So I actually was on their side with this one, which I found quite surprising. I know you also find CCTV everywhere and facial recognition creepy. What did you think of this?
When I read the details of it, because like initially you want to think, oh, they're facial recognizing everybody walks in and then what, like building marketing profiles and selling it to advertisers. But no, in this case, kind of limited, kind of targeted, and you get the impression that they actually thought about it, about the data retention, about the things that they were doing, and that seems a lot more reasonable. And I, you know, the natural comparison is like they pay a security guard to stand by the door and look at people, and then they have a, you know, a bunch of pictures of like, here's people who've been shoplifting, here's people who are banned from the store on the wall by the entrance, and then the security guard looks at people coming through, go, oh, that guy looks like the dude we threw out last week, maybe I'll keep an eye on him. Like, that doesn't seem unreasonable to me. And for all of the egregious, you know, unnecessary use of creepy surveillance tech that there is in the modern world, like, this one seemed like a weird one to call out and make
an
example.
But then we look at the police use of facial recognition where it's the same thing. Well, police are on the lookout for these people who have outstanding warrants. But when you automate it, and it can be error-prone and whatever, in that context, it doesn't feel right because it can make a mistake and put that person's life in jeopardy if they are mistakenly identified as like a violent offender, right? So in that instance, yeah, not so great. In this instance, it just feels different, doesn't it? So it's almost like you can't have, again, like with the disclosures of or coverage of hacked materials, you just sort of need to use your intuition a little bit on this stuff, I think. It's you know, the rules are going to be rubbery.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, an absolutist position at either end of any scale is always going to be kind of wrong, right? There's going to be some middle ground where, you know, there is a trade-off between privacy and safety and security and, you know, what's acceptable to society and what's not. And, you know, we are still figuring out where that is as a society because the stuff does have legitimate uses. I mean, you could pay enough people to stand at the door of Bunnings and check everybody. Like, you could do it. But, you know, if we can do it cheaper and as effectively with technology, then maybe there is something to be said. But then you see the, you know, the stuff that happens in China with large scale, you know, monitoring of people and social credit scores and all sorts of other, and it becomes creepy and dystopian. So, yeah, you know, we have to kind of walk a middle ground because neither end of the scale is good. So
yeah, well, I feel like Bunnings were actually walking the middle ground here, which is why I thought the ruling was a little bit unfair. But look, mate, we're going to wrap it up there. Great to chat to you as always, and I look forward to doing it with you again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. I will see you then.
All right, it's time for our sponsor interview now with Andrew Morris, who is a founder of Greynoise. Greynoise operates like internet-wide honeypots, basically, and they use that to figure out where mass scanning activity is coming from. They can also use it to find zero-day vaults that people are just spraying out there over the internet. And Andrew joined me for this interview last week, where we spoke about just how bad things have gotten with mass scanning and mass exploitation of stuff like the Palo stuff that we spoke about earlier in the news. So I'll drop you in here where I actually set up the interview. Enjoy. So you're here to share some good news, Andrew, which is that the mass scanning that's happening on the internet targeting border devices is just so much worse than people realize. Hey.
Hey, good news, everyone. Good news for people who love bad news.
So there's been reporting lately on just edge devices getting compromised, right? And so some of the stuff that I've been reading around, some of the reporting kind of makes it sound like this is like something that starts and stops, or like it kind of goes up or goes down. But it's like very loud all the time. There are a handful of new kind of OS, usually OS command injection vulnerabilities in widely sort of deployed enterprise, usually gateways. So like firewalls, edge gateways, VPNs and stuff like that. And in a report that I saw recently that listed out 50 different vulnerabilities, probably 40 of them were vulnerabilities that we'd seen in the wild exploitation of in Greynoise that day, like today. And it's also true. It's going to be true tomorrow too. It just doesn't end.
We report on this stuff, right? Where we say, oh, gee, you know, there's a campaign targeting Fortinet, right? And, you know, we do tend to talk about it like, well, that was happening a few weeks ago. You know what I mean? And you're just waiting on the next batch of vulns. But I guess what you're getting at is that it's just constantly,
it's constantly happening. Yeah. And one of the things that you can see is that it's twofold. So one is that you want to bad guys want to gain access to networks where they're gonna have juicy targets, but they also want to build up these ORBs operational relay boxes, right? Like building up their farm of accesses so that they can continue to build these things up. And it kind of like it begets compromising edge devices begets compromising other edge devices more easily.
I mean, this is the 90s playbook, really. Like nothing's really changed when maybe someone would go and pop a couple of, Unix boxes and they would be your staging points to go and rinse a bunch of clients. You know, back in the good old days when home Windows didn't have firewalls, right?
Yeah, and the funny thing is that this is like I remember when I was learning hacking, when I was like a teenager, and I remember having to like learn the difference between like when you'd want to use a bind shell and a reverse shell. And it's really funny because now, bind shells are back in again because people are compromising devices on the edge where you're like directly routable. Like it's the 90s again.
Yeah. It does sort of feel like, to your point, that we're kind of hitting crisis levels with this at the moment.
If this isn't crisis levels, I don't know what is. I don't want to sound like, like Chicken Little or anything, but like it's tough to think about it getting sort of much worse than this. I think there's something there to like having the devices not be on or having all services listening all the time. I think that there's very much there. I will say
there was one idea that was actually floated to me by HD Moore, which is if you're using something like CrowdStrike, you can actually get pretty good IP information from CrowdStrike of where your endpoints are. And you can use that as the basis for an allow list for these edge devices, which is a pretty interesting idea. I mean, it would be a little bit fiddly and you're not going to get complete coverage, but I would think that that's probably a good one to start with.
I think there's there. Yeah. I mean, like as a general rule, like IT people, there's probably some way that you can roughly figure out where somebody is that you might be able to open up some traffic on in the near term. I mean, at the end of the day, like, I'm a little bit more of a crazy person about it. I think that like the like as many edge devices should be like mowed off the internet is as humanly possible, like in advance of a kinetic conflict or like a worse, more like scary adversary doing it to cause on their timeline to cause as much damage as possible. But like the mow them off the internet in advance, like do it now, right? Like,
but I mean, the problem is, you know, business stops if you do that.
Would you rather have business stop on your terms or on somebody else's terms, though, right?
I think the problem with that, though, is that, you know, you pull a box like that offline, productivity stops, and then the attack doesn't come. And, like, no one's willing to roll the dice on that, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like, we are stuck with these things on the internet.
Yeah, I mean,
I think allow listing of some kind is the solution here, whether or not you're pulling an IP list from CrowdStrike, whether or not using something like, you know, Knock Knock to do it dynamically. But I think the point is, you and I both agree that allowing these things, allowing anyone to connect to these things from anywhere is just insane.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's also, I don't know, it's just, I think that there's, I can't feel that there's like a poetic justice a little bit in we've spent so, as an industry, we've spent so much, so many resources and so much sort of research on hardening the devices that humans are using, like the endpoints, right? Like these laptops and workstations and stuff like that. And yet the most like sort of vulnerable devices that are just getting the shit kicked out of them right now are these embedded systems that are sitting exposed on the internet, like right there, just in front of everybody, just beeping all the time, like passing packets and stuff. And what's even crazier about it is that these are the devices that are moving the traffic to the users, to the edge devices and things like that, where the traffic can be manipulated or it can be routed somewhere else or it can be dropped and stuff like that. So it's just, I don't know, it's baffling. We're in this kind of nasty bed that we seem to have kind of made ourselves. And it's tough. And I really do. Yeah. I mean, I know that, you know, there's like not necessarily allowing all traffic on it, but I really think that they need to be mowed off the internet.
COVID is such a big part of this, right? Because we were getting those things off the internet and then COVID happened and we needed fast, cheap, you know, well, cheapish, reliable ways to connect people into, you know, into their work, to be able to do jobs. And what that meant is there was a huge rush on these devices, which breathed new life into companies that otherwise should have been end-of-lifing these type of products, right?
That's right.
Remember when we were going to be zero trust? Remember? And then COVID came and it hurt zero trust. So I think that's a big part of it too.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's entire private equity firms who all they do is buy basically end of life products and put them on kind of life support to be able to kind of keep them alive and keep those, you know, the critical customers or whatever going. But like the whole point is that like they're never going to go away naturally. Like they're just not. If you did a survey right now to try to find like what would the oldest device be that you could find on the internet, it would be as old as the internet itself, guaranteed, if there was any way for you to really figure it out. Things don't go off the internet. They just
don't. Do you still see Code Red in the gray noise data set? NT4 era.
Guaranteed. Yes. Yeah. So we see packets, funny enough, we see packets that are generated by the Windows NT kernel. They could be crafted, you know, by somebody else, but like, I don't think they are.
No.
I don't think they are.
They're not, you know, that's the crazy thing. That's, there are NT boxes out there that are just like their CPU fans are just grinding because they have about 20 different types of malware on them, just grinding away.
The original WannaCry strain is running rampant in gray noise.
Yeah.
The original WannaCry, right? Like from 2017. That's not even that long ago, right? There's way more stuff that's way older. We see Conficker, MS 08067. We see it's like MS 1710 is Eternal Blue. We see stuff going way back even before that. There was another, what is it? Not SQL Slammer, but it was another RPC DCOM vulnerability.
Blaster?
Like, yeah, I think so, actually. We still see that. It never ends.
No, it doesn't. They live among us forever. They are immortal.
And what's baffling about those is that like Microsoft Windows in 1999 is about what these embedded systems, like the level of security that they're at right now, it's about the same, right?
So it's, yeah, like Linux on MIPS.
Yeah,
you know. No memory, no mitigations.
You
like,
can't afford ASLR. Like, no, it's not enough of hardware.
And like the worst web app coding practices of like 2003.
Yeah, they're all like, you know, just shoving very invariables straight into stir copy on light HTTPD. It's like, you know, they've got 64 megabytes of RAM. Like, it's nuts. And you look at these things and you're like, I can't believe it's not even worse. You know, it's bad. It's very bad.
Yeah, it is. So look, staying on the topic though of, you know, well, I guess this isn't really an edge device, but you guys found a, you found some Oday with Sift, which is your LLM based AI like analysis engine that we've talked about before. But basically what it does is it grabs data out of gray noise and can look for Oday. You found stuff before, but nothing this complete. Tell us what you found, who was using it, what did you do, what's the nature of the bug? Just give us a whole spiel on it, because it is fascinating. I've seen you like posting about it.
Yeah, so it's actually kind of tricky to get into the very particulars of the bug, but I'll do what I can. So a couple months ago, we saw a bunch of exploitation attempts. So Sift, basically the way that it works, there's two pieces. There's a clusterer and there's an annotator. The clusterer just determines traffic clusters. It basically takes data and it maps it into a multi-dimensional array space that has sort of members that are close and far to each other. So then we got a new cluster that popped up that we, you know, new thing never happened, new traffic cluster just dropped. And then the annotator is, what is this thing, right? So the annotator is like, hey, this is obviously an OS command injection vulnerability. And so then we tried to map it to any of other tags or signatures or anything like that. There was none. So then we're like, wait, what? What vulnerability is this? It looks like another one, but it's not. So then digging into it, and we're like, oh crap, this is a zero day. Like, there is no vulnerability for this. We ended up figuring out exactly what device it was targeting, and, you know, diagnosing it. So there's two CVEs, there's two bugs. So we reported it to the vendor, we got it fixed. And the two bugs, as it shook out, was improper access controls. Basically, you could get to a page that you shouldn't have been able to get to, and then that page had a OS command injection vulnerability. So then it was command injection vulnerability, so then you could take, you know, gain access to the whole device. So basically with that, we reported it to the vendor. Now, here is the tricky part of this, is that the vendor actually OEM'd some of the hardware under the hood from another manufacturer. So we fixed it for them. But we know of at least four other manufacturers that are using the same OEM hardware under the hood and firmware under the hood that we don't know if it's been fixed in those yet. So the bug is, yeah, it's an OS command injection vulnerability in an IP camera. Okay. But it's in, actually, it affects a lot more products than we realize, some of which I don't think we're able to get a fix at all. And so,
but do these IP cameras, you mentioned that it was, you could access a page. So I presume it's like some sort of web service that sits on these things.
It's a lightweight web server that's running on these things. These are expensive.
And it's open by default just to the whole world.
Yep. And these are like really, really, these aren't like Dahua, like in your, you know, grandma's bodega IP cameras. These are like not screwing around thousands of dollar IP cameras, pan tilt zoom cameras that they tend to use in like really high security areas and stuff like that. But yeah, that's exactly right. They bring a tiny little, I mean, and the thing is, the camera itself is like a feat of modern engineering. It's like an incredible piece of hardware. And then, you know, it comes with this like embedded web server. It's, you know, like 20 lines of C or whatever. And, you know, it's Swiss cheese. It's rough. So,
I guess you're not telling us who the manufacturer is. Is that why you didn't want to get into the details? Because there's so much out there that's still vulnerable?
We've listed the ones that we know about in our blog and in our disclosure. And there's more that we don't know about. This is the first one that, as far as I'm aware, like the thing that I'm excited about on this is that we stole a zero day, right? That's what I'm excited about, right?
Well, and then comes the next question, which is like, who was using this and what were they using it to do?
So somebody was attempting to compromise as many PTZ cameras as humanly possible. I don't know what they were going to do with them after the fact.
So, I mean, I'm guessing they were going to use them as orbs, right?
So either they were going to use them as orbs, or they were going to, I mean, that's what makes the most sense.
Yeah. Because like, were they confining their targeting to any particular geographical region or?
No, this was actually, this blanketed the internet. This hit everybody, which is baffling to me. I can't believe they would just spray it. But I mean, at the same time, that also tells me that like, there are so many of these bugs that somebody is just gonna feel totally comfortable finding a zero day in one of these and blasting it out on the internet, burning it, right? Because he's like, yeah, whatever, I'll just find another one. These things are
But I mean, you haven't burned their shells though. That's the other thing, right? Like every device that they've compromised with this thing, they still have a presence there.
That's right. That's exactly right.
All right, Andrew, we are going to wrap it up there. It's always great to see you, my friend. Always great to have a chinwag, have a chat. Congratulations on using LLMs to actually do something useful and cool. Great to see you, man. And I'll look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Always a pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
That was Andrew Morris there with this week's sponsor interview. And yeah, if you need to know which IPs are naughty and which IPs are nice, Greynoise is your best source for that information. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back soon with more risky business for you all. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.